Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit CAneighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.
If we ever see this in the future, the Senate has to stand up and protect their responsibility under the Constitution to review the record of nominees.
To replace Kennedy with a different justice who liberal, progressive-minded people are prepared to think of as not their friend is a good thing.
Hi, and welcome back to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about the Supreme Court and the courts and the law and the rule of law. And when last you heard from us, we were in Austin, Texas for a live show, which we're going to have to do more of because that was awesome. But since that time, in 2 short weeks, the Senate has voted to confirm Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who took his seat at oral arguments this past Tuesday. Let's have a little listen.
But isn't that what the model penal code had and some states already have? In other words, this is not something that would be created now.
No, well, Justice Kavanaugh, it's true that many states have a statutory
language
that says
the first Monday in October already happened, and a little bit we missed it. And then this week, the court already declined to intervene in a challenge to a North Dakota voter ID law requiring voters to present a current residential street address. Lawyers are saying that that decision will likely prevent thousands of Native American voters who only have PO boxes from casting a ballot in the November election. On Wednesday, at oral argument in a case about the detention of immigrants, Justice Kavanaugh appeared to take a very hard line in favor of mandatory detentions of immigrants long after they'd completed their sentences. This and other things will all need to be discussed about the court and the upcoming 2018 docket. And I promise we will look at all of it closely in an upcoming show. But I don't know about you, but I'm still processing what happened in the last couple of weeks with the nomination and confirmation of Justice Kavanaugh. So we want to do big picture this week. Later on in the show, we are going to talk to Vox's Matt Iglesias about two of his recent columns about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court in the wake of these contentious hearings and the narrow vote. But first, we wanted to turn to Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon to reflect on what happened in the Senate last week, the scope of the FBI investigation, and how we're going to think about the Supreme Court and, frankly, the Senate going forward. Senator Jeff Merkley is the junior United States Senator from Oregon, and he has been since 2009, and he joins me now on the podcast. Senator Merkley, welcome to Amicus.
Thank you so much, Dahlia. It's great to be with you.
And I guess I don't even know how to ask the first question, but we are wrapping up one of the most partisan and rancorous confirmation hearings. The best evidence of that, I think, is President Trump at a White House swearing-in ceremony essentially saying this.
What happened to the Kavanaugh family violates every notion of fairness, decency, and due process. Our country, a man or a woman, must always be presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. And with that, I must state that you, sir, under historic scrutiny, were proven innocent. Thank you.
I guess my first question for you, Senator Merkley, is Brett Kavanaugh took his seat at the court on Tuesday, business as usual. We're all papered over and moving on. How do you think about what has happened and how quickly we've torqued to this is the new reality?
Well, I've got to tell you that I think the wounds are extremely deep. The bitterness is very high because there has been a lot of damage done to both the Senate and enormous damage done to the integrity of the Supreme Court.
And what do you, I want to talk about the Senate in a minute, but when you talk about the integrity of the Supreme Court, one of the paradoxes, of course, is that the Supreme Court, all nine members are now going to collude in performing normalcy. They have to do that. We talk so much on this show about how the justices, the one thing they have is the public respect and reverence for the institution. And so, you know, on Tuesday we had Justice Kagan giggling with Judge Kavanaugh, Justice Sotomayor pinching Justice Gorsuch. They're going to just double down on the proposition that everything is fine at the court. So when you talk about the integrity of the court, what does that look like to you? Just a public sense that the thing is broken regardless of what they're showing us?
Well, the members of the court certainly will do what they can to make things look normal, but they're not normal at all. Yeah, the fact is that the court, which was viewed with respect as I grew up, as a series of umpires weighing the respective provisions of the Constitution against each other and against the evolving strategies of society, are now viewed as basically a super legislature. They're super legislating on issues involving the environment, on workers, on women's reproductive rights, on the issue of corporate power and corporate speech, a whole series of things that largely boil down to a vision among the five Republican members of the court as how to create government by and for the powerful in opposition to the constitutional vision of government by and for the people. Both the stolen Supreme Court seat, stolen from President Obama and delivered to President Trump and filled by Neil Gorsuch, and this nominee, who couldn't meet the standards to serve on any form of court, let alone the Supreme Court. This is lasting damage.
My question for you is, isn't this just a mirror image of what Republicans have said about the court when liberals control the court? In other words, they're just regulating, they're making up law from the bench, they answer to no one. Isn't this ultimately just disserving the idea of the rule of law and this neutral court that we all need to believe in order to function in a constitutional democracy? In other words, the kind of politicization you're describing, doesn't it ultimately just undermine the idea of this independent third branch?
Well, we simply have to call the facts as they are, not as we wish them to be. In my lifetime, I've watched the Supreme Courts in country after country become politicized, make extraordinary rulings that change the course of those countries, and I would think, well, it's great that we have a truly set of impartial jurists struggling to get it right with in terms of implementing the Constitution. But we no longer have that. And so to pretend otherwise is to live in a fantasy world, a world of what we once had and certainly would hope for again, but do not have now.
You've really given voice to the idea that the White House had way too strong a hand on the steering wheel this time around. And, you know, you make the point that they were the ones who were claiming privilege about 100,000 pages of documents. And they also, I think you've argued, had way too much control over the FBI investigation. Is that also something new? Is that a big shift that the White House has generally stood back and let the Senate do its work? Or is this just par for the course? The White House protects their nominees.
It is not par for the course. And in that case of the president exercising presidential privilege, normally you think of that in the context of a president protecting internal conversations of that White House. In this case, however, it was about records from a previous president. It wasn't presidential privilege on behalf of President Bush. It was presidential privilege on behalf of President Trump. And normally, and by the way, these terms are synonymous, they're using it synonymous with executive privilege. So normally, when a president exercises executive privilege, there's a log kept saying this document cannot be disclosed because it meets this test of executive privilege. There was no such log or index for the 100,000 documents that were stamped presidential privilege. And for the Senate to allow the White House to block its efforts to review those documents is a complete complete institutional failure. And it's not that the Senate didn't request those documents. The chair of Judiciary did ask for them. But the fact that he and the majority did not then defend the Senate's role in being able to review information, that is where the majority really fell down. And it wasn't just this. In addition, the White House lawyer, Don McGahn, he called over Republican leaders when they requested information on the 3 years of his service, Kavanaugh's service as staff secretary, something that had been requested by the Senate. And he said essentially to these senators, don't request those documents. So they came back and they said, okay, we're not requesting those 3 years. So 3 years of incredibly important information got blanked out. That's separate and distinct from the 100,000 documents that got marked presidential privilege. And it doesn't even end there, because then the same individual empowered by the White House to mark documents presidential privilege then marked 140,000 pages of documents as committee confidential to prevent the public from being able to see them and to prevent committee members and senators from seeing and they got to see them privately in a special room, but they couldn't discuss the contents with the public or with their staff or with experts. And so there was massive compromise from one end to the other of the ability of the Senate to review his record. And the question everyone would say, okay, so what was the president hiding? What did they want to hide with 100,000 documents stamped presidential privilege? We know that during that time, he worked on issues related to torture. We know he received stolen documents from Senate Democrats after he had said he didn't. Then we did find emails that said he did, even without those 100,000 documents. We know that he worked on various nominations and weighed in on those nominations. What did he say? We would have learned a great deal about his partisanship and his judicial perspective from those documents. That's what the president was hiding, and this is unacceptable. And I filed suit to get those documents. Unfortunately, I waited until the committee forwarded it to the full Senate, because I'm not a member of the committee, and immediately filed suit, but time ran out. I wish I had done it differently. I wish I had filed immediately upon the use of presidential privilege instead of waiting until the issue came to the broader Senate. That's a lesson learned. If we ever see this in the future, the Senate has to stand up and protect their responsibility under the Constitution to review the record of nominees.
Senator Merkley, the other reason I wanted to have you on this week is that you used your time last weekend on the Senate floor to deliver an extraordinary 2-hour floor speech. You started, I think, at 4 in the morning, and you just read testimonies from over 30 sexual assault survivors who'd all written to you. And I know that triggered something of a backlash, that you were folks said, oh, you're just saying believe all women and women never lie. That I don't think was your intent, but I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on what I think is a really kind of silly and fatuous conversation about, you know, all women lie or all women tell the truth. That's such a bizarre and cartoonish construction of what the actual issue was that you were trying, I think, to press on last week.
So what I learned from the people who are writing to me, to the people who are calling me, and I took a lot of phone calls here in the office from individuals as well, from men and women, but mostly women, is they said, Senator, we are all reliving our own experiences with sexual assault. Like this case of the struggle that Dr. Ford had. Should I come forward? Should I not come forward? Will I believe? Will the system be rigged if I do come forward? That this is what they had struggled with in the aftermath of their sexual assault. And those letters are very powerful about laying out, one, that sexual assault is so much more common than many men realize, certainly than I understood, because women generally don't talk about it. They may, you know, some of these women wrote to me and said, I've never spoken to anybody else about this in my life, or I've only told my husband, or I only told a friend shortly after it happened, and I didn't talk to anyone else because I was embarrassed that it had happened. I thought I would be blamed. I thought I had failed to prevent it in some way or another. And just that society rigs the system to blame the women when they are assaulted.
And I think what was deeply disturbing to women was they saw the 11 Republican men on that Judiciary Committee rigging the system against these women who came forward, Debbie Ramirez and Dr. Ford, and that added to their struggle. A number of them wrote, I feel an obligation to share my story now to kind of reinforce the courage that it took for Dr. Ford to share her story, even when she knew that, well, the system might be rigged against her. And so they were very powerful insights on an enormous problem that affects so many millions of women in America who carry the wounds throughout their lifetimes. It affects their choices in life. It affects their relationships in life. And I think we need to honor those women who are sharing their stories and learn from them. Have the fact that they're sharing their stories be something that changes our and enhances our understanding and hopefully eventually our ability to respond to both prevent or respond to events when they happen.
And do you worry, Senator, that the aggregate backlash here isn't just that women are going to be afraid to come forward? I think that's a big chunk of it. But the other fear is that now we're getting this trope of they'd better have evidence when they do. I think this week, the First Lady, Melania Trump, essentially made the point, you know, believe women, but boy, they'd better have good evidence. And it seems to me that that's actually moving backward. I mean, we haven't made those kinds of demands of women as a legal matter for a long time now. And so I guess what I'm asking is, we have two problems now. We have a chilling effect, but also people are now starting to say out loud something that sounds an awful lot like, in every he says, she says, the woman's going to lose unless she has good evidence.
Well, I think that's exactly what it sounds like. And in the case of Debbie Ramirez, she had extensive evidence, but the committee refused to hear it. Think for the fact that one of Kavanaugh's suitemates from his freshman year, so someone who lived in the same cluster of bedrooms sharing a common room, he heard about this incident shortly after it happened. He was profoundly disturbed by it. He was disturbed enough that in his first year of graduate school, he shared that story with his roommate. Both he and his roommate were ready to tell the FBI. So you have somebody who shared that story, who heard the story, and then shared the story years before Kavanaugh was ever up for a judicial nomination. So it wasn't inspired in any kind of conceivable way by a partisan effort to derail the nomination. It was simply the facts. You had a corroborating a witness who was not spoken to. And this individual went on to become a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, highly respected. He is deeply involved in a theological setting. He's the last person that the Republicans wanted to share his story. And so they boxed him out and pretended that there was no information. So here you have a situation where the deep fear is that if a woman brings forward her experience, she'll be disrespected, be ignored, corroborating information will be set aside or ignored, and that even worse, she'll be turned and treated as a criminal herself. And the Republicans demonstrated exactly that on the committee when they hired a prosecutor to interrogate her as if she was a criminal. That is completely outrageous for them to set it up in that fashion, but that's exactly what they did.
Last sobering question, Senator, before I let you go, and that is, you've talked pretty repeatedly in this last couple of minutes about Senate Republicans and choices they made. And I think you also said at the very top of the interview that something really broke in the Senate in terms of just a complete collapse of Senate norms, not just of comedy and courtesy and the civility that I think one expects from the Senate, but also just the rules of the game seem to have changed right under your feet. And I guess I wonder, I'm a Supreme Court reporter, I don't watch the Senate enough, but how much of that is really authentically broken? I mean, how much of what we saw in the last few weeks is kind of performance art. And then you get in the elevator and you sling your arm around the other side and say, you know, we're all good. Or how much is irreparably damaged? I guess it's not entirely a fair question, but watching it, it seemed to me as though some line had been crossed. And listening to you talk, it sounds like some line had been crossed. And I'm wondering if that's true, how it gets repaired.
Well, the damage is absolutely deep. To hear a Republican senator, as relayed to me by a couple different colleagues, say, "I will not speak to Democrats," tells you something has happened. I mean, we are angry. Democrats are angry at the horrendous process that did not do justice to our advice and consent responsibility. We're angry that a prevaricator has been put on the court. We're angry that a person with a history of credible allegations of sexual assault has been put on the court. We are angry that a clear partisan who has been involved in many partisan activities over time, an angry partisan at that, has been put on the court. We're angry that the women who came forward were treated so horrendously. Republicans are angry that we're calling them out on it and saying, "You're terrible human beings to have done this, and you failed your legislative responsibilities. You failed your responsibility as senators. You've damaged this institution by what you've done." They're angry for us to say that. So it's deep wounds. We'll certainly keep working on other issues, and we'll certainly reach out from both sides to find partners across the aisle to pursue other issues. But it is a really significant moment in the history of the Senate to have come to this point.
Senator Jeff Merkley serves as the junior United States Senator from the great state of Oregon. He has done so since 2009.
Thank you. Take care now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. Join Slate Live in Brooklyn just 2 days after the November midterms for a recap and a thoughtful, hopefully, discussion. Bring your questions about who won, who lost, what it means for the Supreme Court and the law and the Trump administration. I will be there with Jamel Bowie, Jim Newell, and Mike Pesca to help break it all down. And we'd love to see you. For more information and tickets, go to slate.com/live. We turn now to Matthew Iglesias, who co-founded Vox.com, is a senior correspondent there focused on politics and economic policy. He's co-host of The Weeds podcast. But before all that, he was a columnist here at Slate, and we miss him every day. Matt,
I miss you too.
Oh, thank you. He's the author of two books, most recently, The Rent is Too Damn High, about the policy origins of the middle class housing affordability crisis in America. And he's also an author of a column that garnered not one but four letters to this podcast demanding that we interview him. So, Matt, by reader acclaim, welcome to Amicus.
I'm really glad to be here.
So the column that you wrote right after the dust had settled on Susan Collins and Jeff Flake, and it was manifest how the Senate vote was going to go, it dropped, I think, last Friday. And I'm just going to read the title. Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation will delegitimize the Supreme Court, and that's good. And then the subtitle, even more nihilist. It's time America woke up to the radical right that's run the court for years. You can imagine that for someone like me, who is a true believer in the Supreme Court, that was the most existential, destabilizing thing I've ever read. So come on my show and tell me that Absolutely. The court is a joke. Come on.
It's not that it's a joke, but, well, you know, it's a little bit of the old slate trolling there. But look, I mean, you know, there's a proud tradition in the politics and the rhetoric of the right in the United States of looking at Supreme Court rulings that strike down, that move in a progressive direction. And, you know, conservatives have a whole rhetoric of legislating from the bench, and that's bad, and democratic legitimacy, and so on and so forth. And there has not been a comparable rhetoric or political awareness on the left of the scope and extent of sort of activist, quote unquote, judging from the right, or the extent to which, you know, before Justice Kennedy's replacement by Brett Kavanaugh, the court was already quite conservative and firmly in conservative hands. And to me, to replace Kennedy with a different justice who liberal, progressive-minded people are prepared to think of as not their friend is a good thing, because Justice Kennedy was not really a friend to progressives in America.
And I think your point is actually one of parity in the end, right? Like, you're saying that the Supreme Court has been the source of tremendous cynicism and scorn from the political right in this country for decades, and they get to talk about activist judges and ruling from the bench, and it's all political and it's all partisan. So liberals should do that too. And I think the point you make in the article is, like, good, if the scales have fallen off of everyone's eyes, that's a good thing. We can talk honestly. And of course, my only pushback, and this was the basis of my incredibly unfair introduction of your piece, but my only pushback is, what if, Matt, people really need to believe that there is this independent, nonpartisan third branch of government in order to just say, wake up and brush their teeth in the morning? People like me say.
I think on some level we do need to believe in that. I mean, I was even, I shocked myself in a Slack discussion at work this morning, but I was saying, you know, the Supreme Court would never go along with that about something, because I do believe fundamentally. But I think it's important for the justices to also be mindful of their political legitimacy and to be mindful in a balanced way, right? That we had – I thought the outcome of the Affordable Care Act litigation, in which they upheld, you know, a 5-4 majority narrowly upheld a big chunk of the law. But then the court actually tossed out a substantial Medicaid expansion and is responsible for millions of people not having health insurance. And I'm not by any means an expert on the non-commandeering principle that was invoked there. But it was universally played in the press, and you can see in the polling, in the public reaction, as if this ruling was a huge victory for progressives. And that, to me, is just dangerously unbalanced, right? I mean, what you had was a court that came in. It struck down a law duly enacted by Congress. It did so on fairly hazy grounds. I mean, this non-commandeering, whatever it is, it's like this is a conservative version of penumbras and emanations, right? Like, you can scroll through the Constitution, and there's nothing in there about, you know, matching funds linkage for Medicaid expansion. And to have, you know, it's a conservative majority court. They handed down a ruling that gave conservatives a policy win. And then it was played in the media and celebrated by Democrats as this huge victory because they partially didn't throw out the law. And that is a dangerous lack of balance, right? We need, particularly if they're going to be a majority of Republican appointees on the bench, we need them to worry that the public thinks of them as Republican appointees and is concerned that they are going to run amok, and that since they care about the prestige of the court and they want to be seen as legitimate people who are honest brokers, that they need to worry about going too far.
So two codas there. One is, of course, not only was it seen as a massive win for Obama and for progressives in the media, but the conservative legal movement saw it as a massive, unforgivable defection by John Roberts, right? So it's not just that the media doesn't have that parody of both sides, but also that the conservative legal movement still has not forgiven John Roberts for one defection, whereas most of the, at least I think that their counterparts on the left say, Breyer and Kagan, they jump ship all the time. It's okay. People are people. And so I think there is a standard to which each side holds their own justices that you're trying to account for, too.
Right. Well, and just the conservative legal movement is, I think, not what most people think it is, right? That, I mean, I saw continuing in the Kavanaugh debate, right, a lot of people who are not, you know, super plugged into judicial issues, sort of moderate-ish political people. And to them, like, the stakes in this was, are we going to overturn Roe versus Wade and have a situation in which this abortion question is decided by state legislatures? Now, that's obviously an important topic. It's a topic people feel very strongly about. It has a lot of consequences for a lot of people. But it is just not the case that the typical thing that the conservative legal movement is pushing for is a kind of jurisprudence of modesty and of let the legislatures decide for themselves. And, you know, people who cover the court professionally are aware of this, but I think that the mass public does not understand exactly how far-reaching the conservative legal movement's aspirations are, particularly on questions related to economic policy and regulation. And that was something you really saw in that ACA case, and that was not, I think, processed in quite the right way, and that I hope Kavanaugh will help people, you know, to really understand what's happening here.
So you make the point in your piece that you want to carbon date what you say is a really ambitious right-wing project to capture the court and to delegitimize not just acts of Congress, but the regulatory state. And you carbon date it a little bit to 1995, the Lopez case. That's the case where the court, by a 5-4 margin, invalidated the Gun-Free School Zones Act. But I think that's right descriptively, and you talk about Clarence Thomas's concurrence in that case. But I think that there's also an enormous amount of evidence to suggest that the court has always, going back centuries, been basically a kind of revanchist, backward-leaning, conservative institution that really generally sucks for progressive values. I'm thinking of Ian Millhiser's book, Injustices, Erwin Chemerinsky's book, The Case Against the Supreme Court. In other words, this didn't just start. It has always been the case, Matt, but for a few outliers, that the court arrives at conservative outcomes and foils progressive values, right?
Well, I mean, that has been the predominant history of the Supreme Court. I mean, I think that we have had for a long time, a generation that was very shaped by the judicial decisions of the 50s and 60s through to Roe v. Wade in the early 1970s. And that has created a powerful cultural image of the court as a force for, at least on social cultural issues, progressive forces. The broad history of the Gilded Age court was that it was an enormous impediment to progressive economic activism. And, you know, I think it's something we should really worry about in the current polarized political moment, where we can see that people on both sides are voting for Democrats and Republicans, I think mostly on the basis of their sort of cultural affiliations rather than their economic policy views. And Republicans, at least in their rhetoric, often make gestures of moderation, right? Like, they are all now currently saying that they want the government to take care of people with pre-existing health conditions. But one way you can sort of square the circle of the mismatch between what voters want to hear and what conservative economic policy is you can put on the bench, judges who will rule the way that Republican attorneys general are asking them to rule in this new ACA litigation, which is to throw out the regulations that Republican senators say that they support. And so if you can get people to sort of think of politics as a culture war, and then when you win, you can put in judges who will advance, you know, your sort of least popular economic ideas, you can both, you know, make headway there and also really narrow the scope of democratic debate, right? To say that, look, whether or not we can govern the economy is not really on the ballot here. So what politics is about is sort of, are we going to symbolically affirm the role of immigrants or women or whatnot? And that to me is sort of what happened in the Gilded Age. And it's a risk. I don't want to say that John Roberts or Brett Kavanaugh are going to do that, but they certainly might, right? This is a fear that people should have.
And you talk about in the piece, and I think it's so important, this massive disconnect between progressives who think, oh, we have a basically centrist court because abortion is still legal, right? So we must be winning.
Right.
And the slow dismantling of, say, the regulatory state that is starting, really, I think, will start to happen in earnest with Justice Kavanaugh. But, you know, we've seen that going on. And I would add to that the really alarming cabining of voting rights that has happened.
Right.
And so I think that there's a weird, again, mismatch here, and you're trying to describe it between Democrats who really think the court's been in play. You know, this has been a centrist, moderate court because of Whole Women's Health and Obergefell, but that in fact on the economic, regulatory, big business, access to justice issues, Democrats have been losing for a long time.
Right. And I mean, it's not to downplay the importance of the abortion or marriage equality issues, obviously. Although, you know, two points on that. One is just that I think the post-Sandra Day O'Connor jurisprudence on abortion rights has been somewhat more conservative than most people actually recognize. But, you know, there have been a lot of good articles on this, but like how limited women's practical access to abortion is in the more conservative parts of the country, right? Under the sort of current jurisprudence is a big deal. Then, you know, the Obergefell, obviously that decision is a cultural landmark. But also if you look at how public opinion has evolved on that issue, right, had that ruling come down the other way, it's not like we would still be forever in the 2004 situation in terms of LGBT rights, right? I mean, that cause has just become enormously more popular and you would have won it elsewhere. Whereas the just majority of litigation that happens is about business and businesses clash with regulators. And for a long time now, you've had, you know, conservative justices really hampering the ability of the EPA to use the Clean Air Act in an aggressive way and cutting in lots of ways, particularly at voting rights and at campaign finance, right, at the sort of foundation stones of people's efforts to create a stable democracy with popular control. And so it's interesting because they've never put down like one big ruling, but it's instead, you know, a whole series of campaign finance decisions, a whole series of voting rights decisions, a whole series of little cuts at the regulatory state, a chipping away in that ACA decision of Congress's ability to use its spending powers. And nobody really knows how far they're going to take it, right? But it's something that there should be a lot of alarm about, particularly because of the interplay of undermining voting rights and campaign finance, winning elections with minorities, installing judges who then prevent you from governing when you have a majority. It's a quite dire situation that progressives need to be mindful of.
So that leads to another point you made in your piece. I'm just going to read it. You say, quote, Donald Trump lost the popular vote and the senators who are voting with him to install Kavanaugh on the bench represent a minority of the American population. Neil Gorsuch also secured his lifetime appointment under similarly minoritarian circumstances, end quote. Michael Tomasky made a similar point very explicitly last week. I think he ran the numbers and said now he's talking about Neil Gorsuch from last year. The 54 senators who voted to elevate Justice Gorsuch received around 54 million votes, and the 45 senators who opposed him got more than 73 million votes. That's 58% to 42%, he writes. So you've got, and I think this is the point you're making, you've got a minority-majority president, thanks to the Electoral College, and a minority-majority Senate that just seated a justice who, ironically, is in the branch of government that's supposed to be securing counter-majoritarian interests.
Exactly. And, you know, that's not great, right? And then...
Agreed!
And then it also should be said, right, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if this would pass muster in law school, but there are different ways in which you could have courts acting counter to majorities, right? And the sort of classic, I think, you know, individual rights, civil libertarian view is you might have like a powerless individual, right, up against the forces of the state. Right. And the courts are going to come rescue this person who maybe belongs to a small religious minority group or, you know, is otherwise disempowered through the political process. Then another thing you could have, which I think is what you've gotten a lot of from Brett Kavanaugh on the appeals court, is like a giant bank that has plenty of access to the political system, right, that gets all of its phone calls answered by members of Congress, that has lobbyists everywhere, and that simply lost an argument and got a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau established, even though they didn't want it to be established, and now wants to come and say, no, you need to rule that the structure of this agency is unconstitutional. And that's the kind of counter-majoritarian claim that the conservative legal movement has been very open to hearing, right, is not sort of vindicating the claims of people who are shut out from power in the system or helpless without recourse to the courts, but actually very powerful actors who sometimes lose political battles and now get to sort of refight them in the judicial system. And this really comes to a head, I think, with some of the EPA stuff where, you know, Congress decided in the 70s that given the realities of American politics, it was not going to be feasible for every time experts began to identify an air pollution hazard to come running to Capitol Hill and expect a new law to get passed. So instead, they were going to create an agency, and the agency was going to have a broad mandate to analyze science and promulgate regulations in keeping with newly updated information about harms to human beings. And that, to me, is a good idea. That was a pragmatic response to how the world works and to the fact that it's useful to not have air pollution running amok. And we've seen a tremendous impulse from conservatives to basically say that that setup is illegitimate and that, you know, judges are going to second guess the analysis of scientists, that we're going to call this an illegitimate, unelected branch of government, and to, you know, really try to say that we just cannot have expert-dominated agencies and that Congress needs to use a basically unworkable procedure if it wants to regulate the economy.
So I want to ask you one more pushy backy question,
and
let's do it. Having already proven I am no match for your nihilism about the institution of the Supreme Court, my only, and I should just caveat this with I just spoke earlier in the show with Senator Merkley, who essentially said the same thing. Look, have your illusions and ideals about an independent judiciary, but when it's bought and paid for by the Koch brothers, it's time to call it what it is, which is, I think, in effect, what you're saying. And here's my resistance, Matt, tell me why I'm wrong. And that is, lower courts have been the sole bulwark against the worst forms of Trumpism in the last 2 years. So it is actually federal district judges and federal appeals courts who are pushing back on attempts to dismantle DACA, sanctuary cities, the ban on trans soldiers serving in the military. This has all been because the courts, federal Article III courts, are standing up and saying, no, the rule of law and the Constitution still mean something. I think I worry that the scales have fallen from our eyes. Let's call the whole thing a, you know, political hacky sack. I see the utility in saying it, but do you worry about the damaging effects to really the only branch of government that has held what I think is really frightening authoritarian acts of Congress and this president at bay?
Well, I mean, look, I think it's great when judges can do good things.
thank you. I'm mollified.
At the same time, I mean, I just think it's important to remember that the ultimate upshot of all that travel ban litigation was that the Supreme Court upheld it in the end, right? I mean, and just that I think in a lot of ways it would be a mistake for progressives to take the view that the legal system is going to save us from the worst excesses of Trumpism. I mean, I hope it will. I hope that the justices Trump has put up there and that, you know, old time guy like Clarence Thomas or you know, even the Bush era appointees will think twice about some of these things. But, you know, we should also worry that they won't, right? I mean, ultimately, if the current authoritarianism in the government is going to be beaten, it's going to be beaten, you know, at the ballot box, in the streets, with organizing, with regular stuff like that. Judges are not going to hold the line sort of indefinitely. That's not how the system works. And then conversely, it's not that you have to like say, oh, like the whole law is a joke, like it's all meaningless. But the participants in the system need to know that people are watching and that you are not going to completely dismantle the regulatory state without anybody noticing. And my fear is that for most of the 21st century, they have been able to do that in effect, right? That people's understanding of what is constitutional law about was so dominated by the abortion issue that things could happen on other topics with very little attention being paid. I mean, the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act, it never received mainstream attention. It was not a subject of public commentary in the way that it deserves to have been, and in a way that's going to be enormously consequential going forward, right? I mean, we want to talk about, you know, what bulwarks do we have? Well, like, the main bulwark we should have is that people are going to be able to vote in the United States, but it's not entirely clear how much they're going to be able to. And it's important, I just think, for, you know, political entrepreneurs, for senators like Jeff Merkley to be able to go out there and be heard and be understood as making a kind of a strong case against these guys.
So I do have to point out the subtle irony of we've just had the most extraordinary uptick in interest by women around Dr. Blasey Ford and the Me Too women, and at least the intimation that women are activated around the court in ways that they have not been. And I think you're not wrong, but it is ironic to be pointing out that reproductive rights is the issue we've all been way too myopic about. So there is a way in which I think that the laser focus on reproductive rights, women have not yet begun to fight. You just
yes.
Wait, Matt. They're gonna show you. But I think you're quite right. I think that whether it was Obergefell or Whole Women's Health, we didn't show up, particularly, I think, on the important voting rights cases that were all decided last year with Justice Kennedy and the majority. But I think now is going to be the moment where the decision to not pay attention may be manifest in November on the circumscribed voting rights.
Absolutely. I would also say, I mean, on the reproductive rights issue, there's an important scenario in which, you know, as I think you and many other commentators have noted, that they simply sort of continue to narrow the meaning of Casey while upholding it in some sense. And particularly with women, professional women, mobilized politically in an unprecedented way, it will be really good. It will be very important for people to be paying close attention to what kind of rulings come down and what their real implication is. Because it's possible that we'll have a new five-justice majority that's like, oh, we're ripping off the Band-Aid, like we finally got rid of this terrible precedent. But it's also very possible that they will act more subtly than that and that people be – I don't want to say it's good that Brett Kavanaugh is on the bench, but I think that people, women especially, are aware that they should be suspicious of this guy and what he's up to and whose interests he's really beholding, and that it will be, you know, to the good for the country to have a close level of scrutiny on this kind of thing. Because, you know, the law, it's very nuanced. It's very technical. On some level, it's very important to have experts evaluating things. But the kind of biggest picture constitutional questions really are things that normal people, you know, are entitled to have an opinion on, entitled to have strong feelings about, and entitled to have, I think, a healthy degree of skepticism about the objectivity and nonpartisanship of the judges up there.
Okay, speed round?
Let's do it.
Okay. So I think you lay out, you know, a dream scenario where progressives mobilize and organize and vote around the court for the first time in many decades. Let's say Democrats regain the Senate. Court packing? Yes or no?
Hopefully it won't come to that. I mean, I think that what happened in the New Deal is what you want to see, right? Which is there was some talk of court packing and there was some reconsideration on the part of the Chief Justice at the time of like, what did they really want to be doing? And we didn't ultimately wind up tearing down the judiciary, but instead got a useful course correction. And I hope that's what we'll see.
Hey, you're the cynical one who says it's all just about power and there's nothing magic. Why can't we just pack the court? Well, just it's just like, come on, let's
well,
make
I
it
mean,
bigger.
Well, I mean, well, look, you know, if that's what you have to do, right? I mean, we should not go through a replay of the 1870s and 1880s, right, in which the Supreme Court threw out civil rights legislation, threw out all economic legislation. And I don't really know what was going on in the political system at the time, but it seemed like people felt they had to just take it, right? But my hope would be, like, there are multiple dimensions of power and that one thing Chief Justice Roberts would like is to not have the court packed and all of his power taken away. And consequently, he will try to steer people on a prudent course. But what that means is going to depend on how mobilized the opposition is.
Okay. Round two of the speed round. Impeachment?
I don't know. I mean, you got to take a look at some of this stuff, but it's really hard to get 67 votes for anything.
Term limits? 18-year term limits for Supreme Court justices?
I think fixed terms is a very good idea. You have to come up with some way to do that that doesn't seem like a partisan power grab. But I think it's worth trying to explore.
Okay, last question before I let you go. You were very generous on the speed round. I don't think we've ever done a lightning round on Amicus before. And so we're going to send you a mug or something.
There we go.
But we don't have mugs. You wrote another column at the beginning of this week that I also just wanted to briefly talk about because it was debunking another popular view, which is like Democrats really blew it and they misplayed this and the Senate Democrats were worked and the Republicans did everything right. You absolutely didn't agree with that. And I'd love to just hear from you about that for a second, because I thought it was very, very slate pitchy, but also very persuasive.
Sure. I mean, it's just important to keep in mind how weird the timing was, particularly around Justice Scalia's death, right? I mean, Democrats are angry about the Merrick Garland situation and, you know, with good reason. But also, you had the justices normally strategically time their retirements, right? If he hadn't happened to have passed away unexpectedly and had simply retired during Donald Trump's presidency, nobody would be like, aha, Mitch McConnell, he's a strategic genius. And if Justice Scalia had passed away a little bit earlier when Democrats controlled the Senate, then there would be a progressive majority on the court and nobody would be saying Mitch McConnell is a strategic genius. So the entire genius lay in a fairly small coincidence of timing. On top of that, you know, they lost two Senate seats in 2016. So it's not like – it's not exactly like they got away with it or, you know, this didn't have any cost to anybody. And the real moment at which progressives lost the court was a long, long, long time ago. And it's when Justice Marshall I wasn't really – paying attention to politics at this time, but I guess he was very ill and he felt he had to step down even though there was a Republican president. He was replaced by Clarence Thomas. And so the most progressive justice was replaced by the most conservative justice. And that has had a huge 25-year, you know, long tail of influence on the law and on American society. But none of the players in that drama are around anymore. And it had nothing to do with ruthlessness, right? It was just a I don't know, like bad luck, bad health. It's weird things happen in life.
They do happen. I think before I really truly let you walk away, I want to ask you one of the points you made in this piece about how Democrats didn't get outplayed. And I think it's so important. And I think a lot of folks are mulling this. And your point was Democrats don't have to play dirty going forward. In other words, the way to reclaim whatever has been lost doesn't require tricks and ill will.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the rhetoric of playing dirty, in part because some of the stuff that gets put under that banner is stuff that I don't think is dirty, right? So, like, letting residents of the District of Columbia have representation in Congress is not like a underhanded trick,
right?
Right? Like, if we had representation and somebody proposed taking it away, that would be fighting dirty, right? And, you know, so, I mean, I think Democrats should think about politics, right? And they should think about how the things they do impact voting behavior. But most of the struggles we're seeing, right? I mean, they're around voting rights. They're around, you know, statehood for different kinds of places. They're around gerrymandering. And a basic claim for fairness that everybody should get to vote and everybody's vote should count equally, those are steps that will greatly advantage progressives in a concrete way, but they're also steps that are just incredibly defensible on their own terms. They don't involve any kind of tricks or like dirty fighting or something like that. And it can, in a weird way, sort of feel good to say like, oh, well, we're going to wear the black hats now. But it's very misleading. There's no need for that. It's not super clear that that's really how Republicans have gained the advantage. And it to, you know, fair-minded people who are not like incredibly online and super geared up about things all the time, it makes you sound like a crazy person when you're characterizing your own ideas as fighting dirty.
We are taking a strong stand yet again on Amicus against sounding like a crazy person. Matthew Iglesias,
yes,
co-founded Vox.com, is a senior correspondent there focused on politics and economic policy. He's co-host of the Weeds podcast. And before all that, he found his home here at Slate.com. Matt, it is just, first of all, you're a good sport because this was a little bit of a Dada interview. But thank you so much for joining us this week on Amicus.
Thank you.
Now, that is legit the end of this episode of Amicus. Thank you so much for listening in. If you would like to get in touch, our email is amicus@slate.com, and you can always find us at facebook.com/amicuspodcast. Thank you, as ever, for your letters and feedback. As you know from today's podcast, we listen and obey. Today's show was produced by Sarah Birmingham. Steve Lichtai is our executive producer, and June Thomas is senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts. We will be back with another episode of Amicus and a look under the hood of the docket this term in 2 short weeks.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy, interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood. Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit ca-neighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.